Nancy Peroso conducting an interview in Winnipeg on November 26, 2012. And I'll have our narrator for today introduce himself and perhaps just a brief introduction to your career in the grain trade.
My name is Paul Westall. I've been in the grain trade for over 30 years. Spent most of my time in the with the Canadian Wheat Board, various capacities. After that, I moved to the International Grains Institute for a period of time. And then I've been working with Agritech International for the last number of years as well. I would divide my career into those three subsections, and overlaid on that is the development of a technology company. I'm a founder of a technology company as well. And so those are the main activities that I've been involved in the grain trade.
Now, when you say a technology company, what type of technology?
Protein extraction.
Oh, okay.
Canola protein extraction. A number of years ago, I became aware of a technology that was apparently developed and available, but in experimental form, to extract pure protein from canola meal. And it was a highly valued and highly nutritious substance, food ingredient, and I picked up on that idea and together with a partner co-founded a company that has now become a major player in the food ingredient research and development field. It's a publicly listed company now traded on the Toronto Stock Exchange.
And what is its name?
Its name is Burcon Nutriscience.
Burcon?
Burcon Nutriscience.
Okay.
We founded, my partner and I founded the initial company in 1991. In 1999, we met the people from Burcon, and we entered into an agreement with them to commercialize the technology. And the story goes forward from there. And we now have a development agreement with Archer Daniels Midland to work on canola proteins, but now we've shifted to soy protein, which turns out to be a more readily commercializable product.
Hmm. Now, the initial research that was done into isolating the protein, was that done? What lab was taking responsibility for that, or what research?
It was actually a private initiative conducted by my co-founder, my partner, who did this working for a company on his own and in no particular lab. So it's really attributable to him. He's the author of the technology, and we are the owners of the technology.
Mm. And what is his name?
His name is Don Murray. And he used to be in Winnipeg. We worked together for many years, and he lives in Ontario.
Okay. Toronto or?
And Guelph.
Guelph.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Now, I'm always interested in finding out, well, first of all, what year did you start working?
1970.
Okay.
And here in Winnipeg at the Canadian Wheat Board.
Right.
That was my first employment.
And what attracted you to the grain industry? Did you grow up on a farm, or?
Didn't grow up on a farm. Grew up in Swan River in a farm community, Swan River, Manitoba. But actually, the initial interest was in wildlife conservation, a natural, naturalist environmental area. But it turned out that that wasn't a field at university that was available for study as such at the time here at the University of Manitoba. So found my way into the next best thing, which was agriculture, and wound up being very happy to go through an agricultural program, specializing in agricultural economics. And had the good fortune to be mentored by some excellent people, including Clay Gilson, who was a towering figure in the grain industry and in agricultural policy for many years in Western Canada.
Did you specialize within the economics? Did you have a special interest while you were going to school?
Grain marketing primarily, but my thesis was on the subject of crop insurance, which was very topical at the time, having been well established and being developed and refined and improved. It was actually founded in the province by Clay Gilson. He was a driving force behind the introduction of crop insurance in Western Canada, and so it was an ongoing interest of his, and I was lucky enough to go along for the ride to be part of that.
And that took you pretty understandably into the Canadian wheat board. So what position did you apply for there when you first started?
At the time, the board was looking for university-trained specialists in grain marketing, in particular to try and enhance, develop their marketing efforts overseas. And I joined together with a number of other younger people at the time, a group that went forward, and we were called area specialists at the time, and our jobs were to try and develop markets for sales for Canadian grain in different parts of the world.
Can you recall some of the names of the people who were there, and in particular who you worked for?
I can recall David Clark and Bob Broska, and I can recall Brian Olson, and these are all people that I keep in touch with today, but they were part of that original team.
And the supervisor of that group at the time?
That would have been, there were two, Alec Kubicek, who's still around, and he's a well-respected member of the grain trade, grain industry. And Herman Diepenbrock was there as well. These were the two supervisors of that section. And Harold Bjarnason, who is well known in the grain industry. He, I think, latterly was the Dean of Agriculture at the University of Manitoba and held an assistant deputy minister's position in the federal government as well before that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the people coming into the position at the time were known as area
specialists.
So what was your
Western
area?
Europe is where I started off, and that's really essentially where I spent most of my time. And that's one of the reasons that I was asked to go to London and take over the position of the office manager of the London office. At the time, the Wheat Board had an office in London, England, and it had an office in Tokyo. So those were the two offices, overseas offices that the board had at the time. Since then, they added an office in Beijing, and now, of course, things have changed, and we're not too sure how that's all going to unfold. They believe they still have the two offices, the one in Beijing and the other one in Tokyo, going forward. But the one in England, in the UK, is not, and in fact, the last thing that I did there was to close the office in London.
Now, asking you to think back to 1970 and starting out in the grain industry as a area specialist, what can you describe that job, what it required you to do, what you learned doing that job?
Well, it required a lot of monitoring of markets, doing assessments of requirements, understanding the customer's requirements, both obviously quantitative and in terms of the conditions of the crops in their own countries and how that might affect demand for Canadian wheat, and trying to determine what particular advantage Canadian wheat had in the markets and how to enhance the prospects for our sales in those markets in my area, and the other area specialists did the same, and then feeding all of this information into the master sales plan for the board and developing a priority marketing plan. So we were involved in all of that. It also involved an awful lot of overseas travel. That was a big part of it. And we were away for long periods of time. I remember that I was away on one occasion for 6 weeks from home, and others even longer. The area specialist for Africa, I think he was gone 8 or 9 weeks on one trip, which is quite unheard of these days. People go away for a week or two, and that's considered a rather long trip, and then they're back home. But transportation was a little bit different then. It was the beginning of mass jet travel around the world, and so that was part of it. And in fact, all those developments in communications have affected the grain industry quite substantially.
Mm-hmm. So, did you find that the countries had different personalities? Were there some that were sort of ripe for market development and others that would be a long process to develop the markets and some that you knew just were never going to amount to customers of any substance?
I would say all of the above. I was based in the UK, and the reason for that was there was a long-standing relationship in grain, in wheat in particular, between the UK and Canada. They relied on us for a long period of time to provide them with high-quality wheat for the baked goods and the wheat-based products that they produced and consumed. That's an interesting story because I was there at the time that that all changed. And it changed in the sense that their reliance on us became much less, for two reasons. One is that the technology changed, and they were able to develop a process to extract protein from their own crop. And that the concentrated protein, they were able to put that back into a grist which contained mostly their wheat, a little bit of ours, and then this additional concentration of protein extracted from their crop. And that left them in a situation where they simply didn't need all this Canadian wheat to essentially improve the quality of their grist and to achieve the performance in the bakeries and the finished product that they needed. So that was a very big change that took place. The second thing that happened was, and maybe this has more to do with, I think, the change in function of the Canadian Wheat Board office, was that, as I mentioned, we were at the beginning of the time of a considerable improvement in transportation, the beginning, really, of mass jet travel, and also communications. When we began, we were still using telex. The clattering telex machine was in our offices in both Winnipeg, of course, and in London. And so that gives you an idea of the state of communications at the time. And so that was all, of course, quickly superseded by much better communications in terms of the communications that we enjoy now. And that made it possible for, really, customer relationships to be managed more from a head office and less so the need to have a representative on the ground. Because when you think that you could have somebody in London, in Rotterdam, in Europe, in a matter of a day or two from the head office, with all the sort of direct management input from the head office, that, in a sense, to a large extent, eliminated the need for an overseas presence. At least that was the decision that was taken at the time. So those were the things that contributed to the change in the arrangements for the UK market. The UK market was our main market at the time. During the time I was there, we had I think 1.2 million tons. It's a very, very big, if not our biggest customer, but it would not have been, of course, compared to the Russians, who at the time were, in fact, taking many millions of tons of grain. Not consistently, but over time, they were huge customers. The UK was in there as well as a major customer. Our opportunities on the continent were not as good, we had less of a loyal customer base in Europe, although that's having said that, the trade in durum wheat into Germany and into Rotterdam and into Western Europe continued apace. It was smaller, but it was good, solid, regular business. But it was of a much smaller scale than our trade into the UK.
And Italy?
Biggest, of course, for durum at the time was Italy, and Italy continues as a big market. But in addition, we had a shift in emphasis, I think we could say, to North Africa, which became a huge market for us. Algeria in particular comes to mind, Morocco in and out, and other North African countries. But that shifted into the millions of tons. Mm-hmm. Italy, of course, stayed in as well as a major market and is so today.
Mm-hmm. the plan for developing a market where one was underdeveloped or non-existent, how did you actually go about that? And I'm talking in a practical sense, what would a day look like when you headed over to Europe and tried to get information about the country that you were hoping to expand the market into? How did you actually go about that?
That's a great question. And essentially, the idea was to penetrate the market using the technical skills that we had and using the first-class quality product that we knew we had and that we were offering to the world. But it was up to us to show customers the advantage of this wonderful product. And it wasn't always clear to them. And they had options, they had alternatives, and they were using wheat from many different sources. So it was incumbent on us to try and find the way to show them how it would be best for them, how they could win markets, and how they could win customers, and how they could satisfy their customers' requirements and still be competitive and make money using our product. So that was the thrust of it. And we relied on a technical services group that's part of that area, that initiative that I mentioned earlier. And we became somewhat familiar with that ourselves, although we were not the specialists. And then often we would have travel in the company of specialists from the Canadian Grain Commission, who of course were the ultimate technical specialists in the field of Canadian wheat.
So Canadian Wheat Board had a separate cadre of technical specialists, separate from the Grain Research Lab?
Small group of technical specialists who worked closely with the Grain Research Lab, the Grain Research Lab and the Canadian Grain Commission. And I suppose we could say that they were the bridge. The Wheat Board specialists were the bridge, and we were part of that as well, between the research people at the Grain Commission and the customer who was actually trying to put it in a commercial grist and make a living gristing and selling our and other wheats. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So would you make connections then with the industry people there, with the government people, with a combination of both?
Both, usually, yes. Industry people. We would visit the private sector mills. We would visit state sector mills as well. Now, in Europe, there was primarily private sector, but then one can think of in Norway, for example, the state granary was still actively buying grain on behalf of Norwegian mills. And there were also associations. There were associations of millers in different countries. So we ended up cultivating relationships with all of those involved in customer countries in the use and of wheat, and certainly in the importation of wheat. And at the same time, we weren't that far past the war time, where there were still concerns about strategic reserves. So in places like Switzerland, there was a strategic reserve. And in other countries in Western Europe, there were reserves, and we therefore were involved in speaking with these people, and very often Canadian wheat would be a part of the reserve.
What would you describe as the biggest challenge that you faced in that part of your career?
I can't think of any one thing in particular. I think it was just the necessity, and it wasn't that difficult to do, of getting out there on the ground and actually visiting with customers and demonstrating the benefits, the use, the economic benefit, and the technical performance of our product. So I think from that point of view, it wasn't any one particular thing. We were always up against competition, and the Americans had good wheat, and they were strong competitors. Australia was at the time also involved from time to time, even though at that point it was very far away as a supplier, but it was a strong competitor there as well. The, we were not certainly daunted by the competition. In fact, it gave us an opportunity to show just how good we thought our product was and how useful and beneficial it could be.
Now, the years that you were in that position,
in,
1970 to into in the
yeah, I'm just thinking
market
the,
development.
In the market development area, 1970, let's say, to 1982.
Okay.
And then from 82 to 86, that's when we were in the UK as office manager for the Canadian Wheat Board office there.
Okay. What, when you think back on that, what was your greatest success?
I think that I'd have to say that the relationships that I developed in the UK, in spite of the shrinking market, allowed us to continue a strong relationship with the major players in the industry. And it developed into a smaller but steady, close relationship and a marketing opportunity that continues to this day. And for example, the Warburton Company was a significant player in the UK market at the time that I was there at the Canadian Wheat Board. Today, they are a major player. And a lot of the growth and development that's taken place in their business, I think, came about in part because of the close relationship that we developed at the beginning with their principals. And that's now transformed itself into a permanent presence for Warburton's. Warburton's is a baking company, so it's a bit odd that a UK baking company would have a permanent presence here in Canada, and they do, through a contract program that's administered by grain companies here, and in which the Canadian Wheat Board had a major role, and the Grains Institute had a major role in developing. So if there's a bit of a legacy from that time, I suppose that would be it.
So if we were to go over to Europe, England in particular, and start munching on some baked goods, we could possibly be eating grain that came from the Canadian prairies.
I think that's true, less so than it was in the past. But certainly, well, this year in particular, there will be many different wheats in the grist because they've had a terrible crop there this year. The quality is not good at all. And they got about half a crop, apparently, so there will be lots of different grist, wheats in the grist. But I think, generally, I think that in the UK, Canadian wheat is still highly regarded. And I think the millers and bakers like to use it. They do so according to the economics of use. And there's, I think they have they retain a special affection for Canadian wheat in their grist.
The any changes in the European common market tariff issue happening at the time that you were there, and did that have any impact?
Yes, indeed. And in fact, it had more. It had pretty much taken hold by the time I arrived. And the reason that the UK, in particular, was developed the technology to extract and concentrate protein in the form of gluten in their products was because there was such a big tariff payable on wheat coming into the community. So Canadian wheat was very expensive, not because we were being unreasonable. We were getting our full value for the wheat. But they faced an import tariff that was quite huge. Sometimes, as I recall, the tariff was greater than the cost of the wheat. So it made it a very expensive proposition. So that created a huge incentive to try and find a way to minimize that costly component of the grist, and gave rise to what was called the Chorleywood process, which is the process I'm referring to, by which they were able to isolate and concentrate protein in their own wheat. So very much so. That was a very big shift for us.
Now, just because we hope at some point to transcribe some of these interviews, Chorleywood. How's that spelled?
Chorleywood. C-H-O-R-L-Y-W-O-O-D, and that's the name of a place. but it's also the name of a quite world famous and in the grain industry, a lot of people would recognize that name as a center of technical excellence for milling and baking. And it's located just outside of London.
The reason behind the tariff, was that to establish a, to guarantee a self-sufficient market?
Yes, that's it. Well, two reasons, right? One was because there were, in parts of Europe after the war, still concerns about food security, because they, in many places, they had known real hunger. So they wanted to be sure that never happened again, so they gave every incentive for farmers to produce. So that was it. And the other thing was that there was a drive, as you know, to bring up farm incomes, to make farming remunerative, and that farm people in rural areas should not be living in a different economic zone than the rest of the community. Mm. And so there were transfers of income by way of crop prices and protection, and export subsidies and import tariffs were part of that whole package.
It seems to me that I'd heard in a previous interview about agents that the Wheat Board used. Was that part, was contacting those agents or developing an agent network, was that part of the marketing as well?
Actually, the from my side, working in the UK, that really wasn't part of it. That got more that was more part of the supply chain, and so individual buyers in the UK would have arrangements with international grain companies, who were the agents as well of the Canadian Wheat Board. I think at one point we had 32 agents, big and small international grain companies. And it was based on those relationships between agents and our customers in the UK, with the Wheat Board being the originator of the grain and the people that I was dealing with being the final consumers and buyers of the grain, and that the supply chain involved the agents as well. And then, in addition to that, the UK individual buyers in some cases had their own UK agents who then worked with international agents who then were buying grain from the Wheat Board. So it was that kind of a supply chain place at the time.
Now, again, going back to things in my past, there's marketing a product, and then there's the keeping the customer satisfied so that you don't have to constantly reestablish a market.
Mm-hmm.
So
was
that... was that part of the plan? Was there an actual interaction between the you people in the marketing side of it and the people who actually had to finally sell and deliver?
Well, the sell and deliver part really would be the execution piece. And so we're talking about the contract and the pricing, and we're talking about shipping and hitting the targets and getting the grain there on time. And we worked with and we were a part of that, but essentially that was driven by from the supply side from Winnipeg with the pricing model that worked out into and we provided input to that, and guidance and advice because we had some knowledge that would not because of our presence in the market that wouldn't be available readily, but it's interesting to think about that because I was there at a time when that all changed. When communications just became that much more rapid and consistent and reliable, and so suddenly everybody knew everything that was happening all over the world. So you didn't need to wait for your man in Tokyo to ring up and say, guess what's happening? A lot of that was already known, and so those were the kinds of changes that took place at the time. But certainly that was part of it. But when you say to satisfy the customer, we were in a very good position there because we really did have and do have the best quality product imaginable. And the other thing is to remember that our efforts over time were at the time to select the best attributes that were consistent with the best performance of wheat and flour in the mills and the bakeries in the UK in particular. So when you think about it, the entire Canadian crop, to a certain extent, was tailor-made for UK requirements to make just the kind of bread that they wanted that would rise so high. It was interesting when I think about it that when I arrived there, one of the observations made as the new man in was, and said in jest, of course, was that, Westall, your job here is to help us to make water stand up on end and sell it for the price of bread, meaning that our wheat had to have the ability to absorb and hold water long enough for it to be sold, there to be a certain weight, a certain price applied to it. But of course, that related to the freshness of the product and the other quality characteristics. But I always remember that was a new approach to my work, to say that was in fact why I was there, from their point of view.
Did anything ever backfire?
Backfire. Backfire. Not really. I can't remember any serious backfiring.
So things went pretty smoothly, as they tend to do when you establish a good relationship with people.
Good relationship, long-standing business with the UK. Customers that we knew for a long time. They knew our people, we knew their people. It was a very convenient and good working relationship. But the pressure came from the, as we mentioned earlier, from the Common Agricultural Policy with the huge import tariff, which made our product as good as it was and as desirable as it was and as much as they were prepared to and wanted to include it, just very expensive. Mm. And so that resulted in the changes we talked about.
Largest competitors, the American and
US
the Australian?
U.S. spring was always competition, and it's in good wheat it is. And the Australians were there as well with their excellent white wheats. So we had good competition, and we were the better for it because we could demonstrate, how good our stuff was as well.
So was it 90% better product, 10% relationships that would give Canada the edge, or would you divide that percentage up a little differently?
I think I'd divide it up a little differently, but you're likely not far off because at the end of the day, the product has to perform. Otherwise, the relationship's ours. So it has to work. And it did work, and it worked well for a long time, and still does. And for example, Warburton's are just a major customer through thick and through thin, through good years and bad. They're always there, and they are, as I say, that's a bit of a legacy piece, I think, for Canadians in that market, the ones who were working there earlier on.
The time that you were at the wheat board, the 1970 to 1982 in Winnipeg, the Canadian International Grains Institute was coming into being. Have I got my...
Yes, I think you're right. I can't remember exactly when it came about, but yes, it was there. And
was it there when you started, or did it come into being?
Came into being after I started, so it was after. And it was in, when I was in London, it was a running and going concern. And one of the things that I did was to help select people from the UK industry to come to Canada and participate in particular the international programs. And I think they were highly successful in maintaining that relationship, in keeping attention focused on Canada as a supplier, and in helping us to differentiate our brand, Canadian wheat, from other wheats.
Did you ever recall talking to someone who had come to take part in those international workshops and their reactions to the time they spent here?
Yes, certainly, and I've kept in touch with many of them. And they, I think, There were a couple of interesting aspects to those programs. One is that they were fairly long. They were 5, 6 weeks originally, then I think back to 5 and back to 4. So really big commitment of time for people to be away from their families, away from their work, and to be with us for that long period of time. And the thrust of it was to be like the Grain Academy. So the Grain, the Institute's position was that we know you're a specialist in something, and you probably won't learn much more about the area that you're specialized in. But all the rest of this complex and integrated grain system, we will teach you about, and we will talk about, and we will offer instruction in, including logistics and handling and oilseed processing and all the whole massive gamut of everything that's involved in the Canadian, in the international grain industry. And took an international perspective at the time.
Yeah, I think perhaps if you sit a bit closer to that.
Yeah, I was just saying that the international grain industry course demanded a lot of participants. So we found that there were well-established people in the grain industry in customer countries, and upcoming movers and shakers in the grain industry as well, who were prepared to, invited to come to Canada and spend up to 6 weeks of their lives with us here studying the international grain industry. So not just their area of specialization, be it marketing or baking or milling or something, but to cover the whole thing, including transportation, including contracts, including marketing, including competitor countries. And we invited competitor countries to come and make presentations on their systems, and it was really quite an open forum approach. I think that based on that approach, we probably solidified and cemented relations with customers that lasted a very long time. But I mentioned that this was, from an industry and education point of view, a very worthwhile exercise, I think, for the participants. But in addition, many of them found being away from home for 5 or 6 weeks in a completely different environment gave them pause to re-examine their own lives. And so they were taken out of context, they were taken out of their country, out of their family, out of their situation. And it was like a sabbatical, not only in the grain industry, but a sabbatical personally. So many of them, when you talk to them after, said that was a life-changing event for me in terms of career. Maybe they decided they wanted to move into one area or another of the grain industry that they'd never thought about. And also personally, that gave them a chance to reflect and see, well, am I really doing what I want to do? Is it going the way I want it to go? Do I need to make a change? So those were some of the things that I noticed about this this big commitment to the grain industry program.
Hmm. Are we ready to move on to your London posting?
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
So how did that come about, and what was your position there?
Well, I was the office manager of the London office, and it was a very small office. There were just three of us, and then just two of us. And it really was a representative outpost. In earlier days, it had a much more active role in the execution of trade. Mentioned that the office was relied upon by Winnipeg head office as a source of information about pricing, about business opportunities, about activities in the markets of both the competitors and customers themselves. So just keeping an ear to the ground and giving a full and complete report on the situation there, and that became that role, that function continued during the time I was there. But I would say its significance is diminished, its importance diminished because of the improvements in communication took place.
So the records of the wheat board then, if they haven't been all destroyed, should include reports from the London office, from the Beijing office, that you were required to send reports in on a regular basis?
Oh, yes, there was a standard reporting procedure. And we were in touch as often as need be with head office to provide the information necessary. But I think at the end of the day, it became a relationship exercise to a great extent, and a market intelligence role as well, Towards the end of my stay there, it became obvious that two things were happening. One is the size of the market had been reduced considerably because of the effect of the common agricultural policy and the new technology that allowed them to use less Canadian wheat in the grist and still have an acceptable product. So those changes took place. So we broadened, we tried to extend the office as well. Area of responsibility to include outlying areas. So I found myself going much further afield than I was going before. And that continued for a while, and then it became obvious that, you know, if we're going to spend 4 hours flying from London to North Africa, we can just as easily send somebody from Winnipeg who maybe will have to spend 8 or 10 hours to make the same journey, and yes, the time frame would be different and so on. But it was judged more expedient to do it that way in the end, and that resulted in the decision, in part, to close the office and concentrate and centralize everything, marketing efforts in Winnipeg.
Did you follow things afterwards to know whether that had any impact, whether pulling an office out where you really had a chance to meet people almost on a daily basis if necessary, having the personal presence removed, did that make any difference or not that you could?
Not that I'm aware of, because we continued to trade certainly into the UK in smaller but regular and steady volumes.
Mm-hmm.
We had already this good relationship with customers.
Mm-hmm.
We maintained that in part through regular visits, but also through the work of the Canadian International Grains Institute. So that mm-hmm. there were a number of contact points there, and they were all useful and helpful. So I don't have any sense that pulling the office out and pulling everything back to Winnipeg changed our situation there. There was no real loss that I could see.
How long had that office been open? Do you know when it?
A good long while. I can't remember when it began, but I'm thinking in the order of 40 or 50 years. It was a good long time that the board had an office.
So
there.
Even before the Second World War?
Well, it would probably. I'm not sure about that. But remember that we had special arrangements with the UK to provide wheat to them during the war. And however, I'm sorry, I don't know the detail of that. I've lost that.
That's fine. At the time that you were doing the marketing and the time in the London office, were you ever responsible for putting on exhibitions and?
Yes, we did participate in a small way. There weren't any fora that necessarily provided that opportunity. For example, agricultural shows, there wouldn't be a Canadian wheat board booth in an agricultural show. And one of the complications there was that in the same way that many countries like to be as self-sufficient as they can be in various areas, the Brits were no different, and they were quite keen to appreciate the fact that they were essentially self-sufficient now in grains. And if not them, then Europe. So it wasn't a terribly popular thing to be able to say that they were relying on North Americans to provide them with the kind of products that their customers had come to appreciate and had been consuming all these years. So there wasn't encouragement from the side of the industry for us to have a major public presence in the UK market.
And what was the interaction between you as sort of a industrial emissary, and the Department of Trade and Commerce federally?
There was contact and communication, but not a great deal. I mean, we went about our business, they went about theirs. We crossed paths on many occasions when there were Canadian functions taking place. in Canada House, in the McDonald House in London, and we invited them to our affairs, and they invited us to theirs. So there was that kind of collaboration. But basically, we stuck to our knitting, and so we didn't really have to rely on them. We had an established business there, so we didn't have to rely on them to open so too many doors for us because the doors were already open.
The years that you were in London, when were those?
82 to 86.
And then I have you, where did your career go from there?
Came back to Winnipeg and then went to the Grains International Grains Institute. And that, so that would have gone from 86 to 2000. Yeah, that's right.
Okay, and what was your...
I was the director of marketing at the Canadian International Grains Institute.
And how did that relate or differ from your previous work in the marketing section of the wheat board?
Well, I would say it flowed seamlessly from one piece to the next. And as you probably gathered from earlier comments, I was quite taken with the effectiveness of the Grains Institute and thought it was a very worthwhile exercise indeed, and that it had helped us enormously. I could see the benefits, certainly in terms of sales on our side and in terms of cementing these long-term, very important, well-established relationships. So it just flowed. I just flowed well into the next part of it, and became quite enamored of the effectiveness of the institute.
And of course, the customer base was broadened substantially from European, because you would be dealing with.
Yes, Southeast Asia at the time was becoming more important. We talked earlier about the shift in grain flow from the east coast to the west, and so that was all happening. So new market opportunities were developing in faraway places in Southeast Asia, and so the Grains Institute adapted to that, and the composition of our international course participants changed to reflect that. So there were probably fewer from Europe than there were in the early days, and more coming from Southeast Asia.
Did that, was there any requirement for changes in marketing practices because of the shift to different countries?
Not in the marketing practices, but in the course content there was, in the sense that we now featured products that were more interest to, technically, more interest to customers in Southeast Asia. And that's when the Grains Institute added a whole noodle-making technology section. And so that was it. And then the qualities of wheats required were different, because in Southeast Asia, the standard British sandwich, loaf, bread, toast bread product is not in great demand. And so it doesn't really matter how high the loaf rises if you're going to be making a steam bun, because that's a completely different product requiring different quality characteristics in the wheat and in the flour. So that was the nature of the shift there. But the marketing side, I would say, didn't change dramatically. We had an office for a long time in Japan. And that office became a bit of a regional office at one point. And then China was added. The Wheat Board added an office in China. And there was always a close working relationship between SIGI, the Grains Institute, the Wheat Board, and the Canadian Grain Commission. And very often we would be traveling together as teams. Marketing, market development teams.
Now, how would you describe the difference between the marketing? What's the marketing? What's the word I'm looking for? The market niche of the Canadian International Grains Institute and the marketing department of the Wheat Board.
Okay, I think it's the Wheat Board's responsibility is the execution part of it, is the sales of it, establishing the quantity, the grades, the shipping period, and the price. And so those are that's really the Wheat Board world right there. The Grains Institute was more involved in the lead-up work in creating the opportunity for the board to sign the contract. So I think that's how I would describe it.
So the wheat board wasn't out directly marketing their product as you were doing when you were...
I think they, as the Grains Institute became more active and involved, I think the board relied on the Institute to provide that kind of soft sell service ahead of there being contracts to, as it were, create the opportunity for the sales to be made.
You mentioned that it was important in order to encourage sales to make sure that what you were selling to them would actually work in the finished product. So if Canadian farmers were growing wheat in large part to satisfy the production needs of European millers, bakers, etc., how did you try to help in a transition? Because as the market started to grow for noodles and other products, it would also make a difference in variety. So how did that all fit together?
Yeah, very, very good point. So there was a shift. And the shift was two things. One is that turned out our wheat was a pretty good all-rounder. So it was good at most things. Not everything, but most things. And so we didn't have too big of a struggle to get it into many different products. The top grades, the highest protein, the top grades worked best in the European, UK applications, I think it's fair to say. The lower grades and different classes of wheat worked better in other applications. For example, white wheat, winter wheat, became more important for some products, noodles, for example, in Southeast Asia. In addition, at the time, and this is going back to the period, I'm sorry, before the earlier on, before the move to the UK, we were working in the market development department, and the shift there was to see if we could find and develop products, classes of wheat, new varieties that more precisely met the requirements of Southeast Asia. And so that's where the different new classes at the time of CPS white wheats came from. And then, of course, at the time, the board also had a big barley program, and malting barley was an important, very important part of that, selling both feed and malting barley in the export markets. And one of the projects that I was involved in was to bring into Canada, because we didn't have anything in our own development programs, a white Aleuron six-row barley that was at the time very popular in the United States. And this represented an effort by us to grow something and produce something here that we knew there was a market for, but that we didn't have in our arsenal of varieties and barley varieties. That was Beacon barley. And we did the same with Clagus, two-row barley, that that was much favored by American buyers, and the Americans were big buyers of our, and big potential buyers, and big buyers of malting barley. So they that represented an attempt by us to respond to changing customer requirements by growing what they wanted to buy.
Anything else about your time with Canadian Grains Institute? Like, that was a 14-year period. So
yes, it was.
What changes and challenges, other than what you've already talked about, mm-hmm. occurred over that time?
Well, the biggest changes that took place during that time, and maybe it wasn't just that time, obviously was the change in the country elevator handling system. it went from being several thousand, 3,000 probably when I started, country elevators spread all across Western Canada.
Pardon me.
It went from a rather large number of wooden cribbed country elevators of very small size, spaced all along the branch lines all across Western Canada, to they were 3,000 and some when I started, to something in the order of 300 today, of large inland terminals. So that's a massive transformation across the landscape, and a huge change overall for the grain industry. So at the Grains Institute, naturally our programs reflected those changes in technology and handling and throughput and all the factors associated with that, and logistics and collection. And the whole process has just accelerated because now we have this enormous concentration in the handling system, we now have a handful of large grain companies, and I guess with the exception of Richardson's, which is a great and wonderful company, the others are a couple of smaller ones. We've got Patterson and Parrish and Heimbecker, and I may be forgetting somebody, who are holding their own in the new environment. But now we have ABCD. The huge big multinationals have taken a major stake in the Canadian